Amongst the black men who came to Kimberley were the young Amadoda of the Matabele. They had been sent by Lobengula. Have I mentioned that Lobengula was a thief? His instruction to his young men was to steal the shiny pebbles and bring them back to him. Tens of thousands of Matabele made the long journey southwards to the diamond diggings, and they brought back diamonds. The diamonds they picked were the largest and the brightest, the ones that showed up most clearly in the washing and processing. How many diamonds? One Matabele, whom the white police caught, had swallowed 348 carats of diamonds worth £3,000 in the coin of those days. Say, 300,000 in today's terms. Another had slipped open his thigh and pouched in his own flesh a single diamond that weighed 200 carats. Peter shrugged. Who can say what its present value might have been? Perhaps £2 million? The old white man, who had been aloof, even disinterested, during the first part of this recital, was now leaning forward intently, his head twisted to watch Peter Fungerbearer's lips. Those were the few that the white police caught. But there were thousands upon thousands of Matabele diamond smugglers who were never caught. Remember, in the early days of the diggings, there was virtually no control over the black labourers. They came and went as the fancy moved them. So some stayed a week before drifting away, others worked a full three-year contract before leaving, but when they went, the shiny pebbles went with them. In their hair, in the heels of their new boots, in their mouths, in their bellies, stuffed up their anuses or in the vaginas of their women. The diamonds went out in thousands upon thousands of carats. Of course it could not last. Rhodes introduced the compound system. The labourers were locked up in barbed wire compounds for the full 3 years of their contract. Before they left, they were stripped naked and placed in special quarantine huts for 10 days, during which time their heads and pudenda were shaved and their bodies minutely examined by the white doctors. Their rare ends were thoroughly probed and their recently healed scars sounded and, if necessary, reopened with a surgeon's scalpel. They were given massive doses of castor oil, and finely meshed screens were placed under the latrines so that their droppings could be washed and processed as though they were the blue earth of the diggings. However, the Matabele were crafty thieves, and they still found ways to get the stones out of the compounds. The river of diamonds had been reduced to a trickle, but the trickle went northwards still to Lobengula. Again, you ask, how many? We can only guess. There was a Matabele named Butso the Axe, who left Kimberley with a belt of diamonds around his waist. You have heard of Butso, son of Gundang, my dear Tungata. He was your great-grandfather. He became a notorious Matabele in Duna and slew hundreds of defenceless Mashona during his depredations. The belt of diamonds that he laid before Lobengula, so legend tells us, weighed the equivalent of 10 ostrich eggs. As a single ostrich egg has the same capacity as 24 domestic hen's eggs, and even allowing for legend's exaggerations, we come to a figure in excess of £5 million sterling in today's inflated currency. Another source tells us that Lobengula had 5 pots full of first water diamonds. That is 5 gallons of diamonds, enough to rock the monopoly of De Beers' central diamond-selling organization. Yet another verbal history talks of the ritual Kombisile that Lobengula held for his Indunas, his tribal councillors. Kombisile is the Sindabile word for a showing or putting on display, Peter explained to the white man and then went on. In the privacy of his great hut, the king would strip naked and his wives would anoint his bloated body with thick beef grease. Then they would stick diamonds into the grease until his entire body was covered in a mosaic of precious stones, a living sculpture covered with £100 million worth of diamonds. So, that is the answer to your question, gentlemen. Lobengula probably had more diamonds than have ever been assembled in one place at one time, other than the vaults of De Beers' central selling organization in London. While this was happening, Rhodes, the richest man in the world, sitting in Kimberley and obsessed with the concept of empire, looked northwards and he dreamed. Such was the strength of his obsession that he began to speak of my north. In the end, he took it as he had done the diamond diggings of Kimberley, a little at a time. He sent his envoys to negotiate with Lobengula, a concession to prospect and exploit the minerals of his domains, which included the land of the Mashona. From the White Queen in England, Rhodes obtained approval for the formation of a royal charter company, and then he sent a private army of hard and ruthless men to occupy these concessions. Lobengula had not expected anything like this. A few men digging little holes, yes, but not an army of brutal adventurers. Firstly, Lobengula protested to no avail. The white men pressed him harder and harder, until they forced him to a fatal error of judgment. Lobengula, feeling his very existence threatened, assembled his impis in a warlike display. This was the provocation for which Rhodes and his henchmen had worked and planned. They fell upon Lobengula in a savage and merciless campaign. They machine-gunned his famous impis and shattered the Matabele nation. Then they galloped to Lobengula's kraal at Gubulawayo. However, Lobengula, that wily thief and coward, had already fled northwards, taking with him his wives, his herds, what remained of his fighting impis, and his diamonds. A small force of white men pursued him for part of the way until they ran into a Matabele ambush and were slaughtered to a man. More white men would have followed Lobengula, but the rains came and turned the veldt to mud and the rivers to torrents. So Lobengula escaped with his treasure. He wandered on northwards without a goal, until the will to go on deserted him. In a wild and lonely place, he called Gandang, his half-brother, to him. He entrusted to him the care of the nation, and coward to the very end, ordered his witch-doctor to prepare a poisonous potion and drank it down. Gandang sat his body upright in a cave. Around his body he placed all Lobengula's possessions, his assegais and regimental plumes and furs, his sleeping mat and headstool, his guns and knives and beer pots, and his diamonds. Lobengula's corpse was wrapped in a sitting position in the green skin of a leopard, and at his feet were placed the 5-gallon beer pots of diamonds. Then the entrance to the cave was carefully sealed and disguised, and Gandang led the Matabele nation back to become the slaves of Rhodes and his Royal Charter Company. You ask when this occurred? It was in the rainy season of the year 1894, not long ago, barely 90 years ago. You ask where? The answer is very close to where we now sit, probably within 20 miles of us. Lobengula travelled directly northwards from Gubulawayo and had almost reached the Zambezi River before he despaired and committed suicide. You ask if any living man knows the exact location of the treasure cave? The answer is yes. Peter Fungerbearer stopped and then exclaimed, "Oh, do forgive me, my dear Tungata. I have neglected to offer you any refreshment." He called for another glass, and when it came, filled it with water and ice, and with his own hands carried it to Tungata. Tungata held the glass in both hands and drank with careful control, a sip at a time. "Now, where was I?" Peter Fungerbearer returned to his chair behind the desk. "You were telling us about the cave." "Ah, yes, of course. Well, it seems that before Lobengula died, he charged his half-brother, Gandang, with the guardianship of the diamonds. He is supposed to have told him, 'There will come a day when my people will need these diamonds. You and your son and his sons will keep this treasure until that day.' So the secret was passed on in the Kumalo family, the so-called royal family of the Matabele. When a chosen son reached his manhood, he was taken by his father or his grandfather on a pilgrimage. Tungata was so reduced by his ordeal that he felt weak and feverish. His mind floated and the iced water in his empty stomach seemed to drug him, so that fantasy became mixed with reality, and the memory of his own pilgrimage to Lobengula's tomb was so vivid that he seemed to be reliving it as he listened to Peter Fungabera's voice. It had been during his first year as an undergraduate at the University of Rhodesia. He had gone home to spend the long vacation with his grandfather. Gideon Kumalo was the assistant headmaster at Kami Mission School, just outside the town of Bulawayo.
"I have a great treat for you,"
the old man had greeted him, smiling through the thick lenses of his spectacles. He still had a little of his eyesight left, though within the following 5 years he would lose the last vestiges of it.
"We are going on a journey together, Vundla,"
was the old man's pet name for him. Vundla, the hare, the clever, lively animal always beloved by the Africans. The slaves had taken him, with them, in legend, to America, in the form of Brer Rabbit. The two of them took the bus northwards, changing half a dozen times at lonely trading stores or remote crossroads, sometimes waiting for 48 hours at a stop, when their connection was delayed. However, the delay did not rankle. They made a picnic of it, sitting at night round their campfire and talking. What marvellous stories old Grandfather Gideon could tell, fables and legends and tribal histories. But it was the histories that fascinated Tungata. He could hear them repeated 50 times without tiring of them. The story of Mzilikazi's exodus from Zululand and the Umfakani. The war with the Boers and the crossing of the Limpopo River. He could recite the names of the glorious Impis and the men who had commanded them, the campaigns they had waged and the battle honours they had won. Most especially, he learned from the old man the history of the moles who burrowed under a mountain, the Impi that had been founded and commanded by his great-grandfather, Butso the Axe. He learned to sing the war songs and the praise songs of the moles, and he dreamed that in a perfect world he would himself have commanded the moles one day, wearing the regimental headband of moleskin and the furs and the feathers. So the pair, the grey-beard, with failing eyesight, and the stripling, travelled together for 5 leisurely companionship-filled days, until at the old man's request the rackety, dusty old bus set them down on a rutted dirt track in the forest. "Mark this spot well, Vundla," Gideon instructed. "Here, the watercourse with the fall of rock, and the kopje over there shaped like a sleeping lion. This is the starting point." They set off northwards through the forest, following a succession of landmarks that the old man made him recite in the form of a rhyming poem. Tungata found he could still recite it without hesitation. "In the beginning is the lion that sleeps. Follow his gaze to the crossing place of the elephant." It was another 3 days' travel at Gideon's reduced pace before he toiled up the steep hillside with Tungata handing him over the worst places, and they stood before the tomb of Lobengula at last. Tungata remembered kneeling before the tomb, sucking blood from the self-inflicted cut on his wrist, and spitting the blood on the rocks that blocked the entrance, and repeating after his grandfather the terrible oath of secrecy and guardianship. Of course, neither the old man nor the oath had mentioned diamonds or treasure. Tungata had merely sworn to guard the secret of the tomb, passing it to his chosen son, until the day when the children of Mashabani cry out for succour, and the stones are burst open to free the spirit of Lobengula, and it shall come forth like fire, Lobengula's fire. After the ceremony, the old man had lain down in the shade of the ficus tree that grew beside the entrance, and exhausted by the long journey, had slept until nightfall. Tungata had remained awake, examining the tomb and the area around it. He had found certain signs that had led him to a conclusion that he did not confide to his grandfather, not then, nor during the journey homewards. He had not wanted to alarm and disturb Gideon. His love for him was too great and protective. Peter Fungabera's voice intruded on his reverie, jerking him back to the present.
"In fact, we are privileged to have with us at this very moment an illustrious member of the Kumalo clan and the present guardian of the old robber's tomb, the Honourable Comrade Minister Tongata Zebiwe.
The white man's pale, cruel eyes riveted him, and Tongata stiffened on the hard wooden bench.
Tongata tried his voice and found that even the small quantity of water that he had taken had eased his throat. His voice was deep and measured, only slightly ragged at the edges.
"You delude yourself, Ungabera."
He made the name into an insult, but Peter's smile never slipped.
"I know nothing of this nonsense that you have dreamed up, and even if I did..."
Tongata did not have to finish the sentence.
"You will find my patience inexhaustible," Peter promised him. "The diamonds have lain there for 90 years. A few more weeks will not spoil them. I have brought with me a doctor to supervise your treatment. We will find just how much you can bear before your Matabele courage fails you. On the other hand, you have the option at any time to make an end to this unpleasantness. You can elect to take us to Lobengula's burial site, and immediately after you have done so, I will arrange to have you flown out of the country to any destination of your choice."
Peter paused before adding the final sweetener to his proposition.
"And with you will go the young woman who so gallantly defended you in the courtroom, Sarah Nyoni."
This time there was a flash of emotion behind the contemptuous mask of Tungata's features.
"Oh, yes," Peter nodded. "We have her safely taken care of." "Your lies need no denial. If you had her, you would have used her already."
Tongata forced himself to believe that Sarah would have obeyed him. She had read and understood the hand sign that he had flashed to her across the courtroom as he was being led away.
"Take cover. Hide yourself. You are in danger."
He had ordered her, and she had acknowledged and agreed. She was safe. He had to believe that. It was all he had to believe in.
"We shall see," Peter Fongobera promised. "Not that it matters."
Tongata had to try and protect her, now that it was clear that the Shona were hunting for Sarah.
"She is a mere woman. Do what you will to her. It will mean little to me."
Fungabera raised his voice.
"Captain!"
The guard commander came immediately.
"Take the prisoner back to his quarters. His treatment will be ordered and supervised by the doctor. Do you understand?"
When they were alone, Colonel Buchanan said quietly,
"He will not be easy. He has physical strength and something else beyond that. Some men simply will not bend, even under the most extreme coercion."
"It may take a little time, but in the end..."
"I am not so certain,"
Bukharin sighed morosely.
"Do you indeed have the woman you spoke of, this Sarah Nyoni?"
Peter hesitated.
"Not yet. She has disappeared. But again, it is only a matter of time. She cannot hide forever."
"Time," Colonel Bukharin repeated. "Yes, there is time for everything, but your time is passing. This thing must be done soon, or not at all."
"Days only, not weeks," Peter promised. But his voice had become thin, and Colonel Bukharin, the consummate hunter of men, sensed his advantage.
"This Zebiwe is a hard man. I am not sure he will respond to the treatment at our clinic. I do not like this business of a diamond treasure. It smacks too much of a story for young boys, and I do not like the fact that you have let this Matabele woman elude you. This whole business begins to depress me."
"You are unduly pessimistic. Everything is going well. I need just a little time to prove it to you."
"You already know that I cannot remain here much longer. I must return to Moscow. And what must I tell them there? That you are digging for treasure?"
Bukharin threw up both hands.
"They will believe that I am turning senile."
"A month,"
Peter Fungabera said.
"I need another month."
"Today is the 10th. You have until the last day of the month to deliver both money and the man to us."
"That is cutting it too fine," Peter protested.
"On the 1st of next month, I will return. If on that date you cannot deliver, I will recommend to my superiors that this entire project be aborted."